Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 10th of November. And Matt, which Bond villain best describes you?
Well, it's such a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, who's the one? I like cats. Who's the one with the cat? Blofeld, was it? Blofeld?
Yeah, he was good. Yeah, Blofeld. I like him. Yeah, I like Jaws. You're the big.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, and you know, became a goodie in the second one.
He did, didn't he? Yeah. So there we are. A bad guy.
Love
turned,
mate, turned him into a good guy. Yeah,
good. Very good. Okay. So what did we talk about? I don't know why we talked about Bond villains.
We'll find out later. We talked about Obama. We talked about Suella Braverman, and we talked about Nadine Dorries.
It was a triple. It was a trifecta,
an unlikely trinity.
What should we call this?
Well, it was about it's complicated, isn't it? Should we call it it's complicated?
Yeah, I think people like, thank you by the way to all those who listened to our Jordan Peterson
episode.
We had a big spike in listeners, so thank you for that. And I think naming the topic helps a little bit. What is Suella Braverman on? Is that clicky? Would you click that list?
I would. I mean, I would certainly click it. Yeah.
Okay.
What's Suella Braverman on?
What is Suella Braverman on?
Yeah.
It doesn't tell the whole story, but it's
no.
Kinda,
but it's right. You know, as Tolstoy said, it's the main point. I don't think he did say that.
You and Dominic Cummins.
I don't think he did. I don't think he did say that.
All right. Okay. All right. Off we go.
All right.
So this is the Two Matts, episode 21. What is Suella Braverman on?
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about? Quite a lot.
Well, there's lots to talk about, but I think what would be interesting, you sent me a very interesting clip of Barack Obama talking, I think in Chicago, at an event, about what's been going on in the Middle East. In fact, maybe the third Matt could give us a taste of that.
If there's any chance of us being able to act constructively to do something, it will require an admission of complexity and maintaining what on the surface may seem contradictory ideas. That what Hamas did was horrific and there's no justification for it. And what is also true is that the occupation and what's happening to Palestinians is unbearable. And what is also true is that there is a history of the Jewish people that may be dismissed unless your grandparents or your great grandparents or your uncle or your aunt tell you stories about the madness of anti-Semitism. And what is true is that there are people right now who are dying who have nothing to do with what Hamas did. And what is true, right? I mean, we can go on for a while.
Yeah, so you get the picture.
Yeah. And by the way, I think it's well worth everybody just Googling Barack Obama.
Yes,
it'll pop up.
I think it's a Pod Save America event. So
right.
Maybe it may appear online as an entire interview, which I would want to listen to.
I was impressed by the word complexity.
Yeah, an admission of complexity is a kind of, you know, that's a a really big thing to say.
Yeah.
What he's really saying is, for all the bright and lurid colours in which inevitably the first month of the conflict have been painted, inevitably and to some extent without apology, in the end, when you're facing a crisis like this, you have to look at the contradictions and complexities. And it takes someone of Obama's gravitas and eloquence, I think, to really make that point with impact.
Because because it's a strange one, isn't it? Because it's actually it's a very simple point, and it's an obviously true point. And yet it feels like it's a hard thing to say. Because
it is a hard thing to say.
Because it inevitably, when you say this isn't simple, it's not a question of the Palestinian people have been wronged and from the river to the sea and all of this business, or on the other hand, the Israeli state is under constant attack and needs to defend itself, and therefore, after this atrocity, all bets are off and it must be given free rein. Neither of those things are true. And I think what is clear to anybody who thinks about this for more than a few seconds and doesn't really have an axe to grind, that, and an axe that may have been ground over years of different inculcations from all sorts of sources and for whatever reason. But for anybody who sits there and says, my God, this is just complicated. And that's the first thing that needs to be acknowledged, isn't it? Before you can move forward.
And I suppose the second thing is that it's going to take people with Obama's statesmanship to even stand a chance of admitting that complexity and turning it into consequential change.
I've got a question for you. Could he have made that statement as president?
Well, I mean, the clip carries on and he says, I asked myself, could I have done more? And that is not just him virtue signaling. It's an expression of frustration because actually Obama's handling of the Middle East peace process was not successful. He and John Kerry tried to, in the second term, Obama's second term, to get Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, and Netanyahu to agree, and they got nowhere. And one of the reasons they got nowhere was that both parties in the conflict sensed correctly that the Obama administration was no longer as invested in the Middle East as, say, the Clinton administration had been. I mean, Clinton was passionate about it. He was devastated that Arafat finally said no to his peace deal. But the Obama administration was not invested in that process. And when, in 2014, those talks collapsed, that was kind of the last time that America has been seriously and heavily involved in the peace process until now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's incorrect to say it's involved in the peace process. I mean, Biden and his Secretary of State and Tony Blinken have been engaged in trying to minimize the carnage and organize humanitarian corridors and shuttle around the various parts of the Middle East, particularly in Blinken's case. But to call that part of the peace process, I think, is to elevate it. And I think this is part of the problem, is that a lot of the debate in the UK is a sort of binary between conflict and peace process. The only reason that there isn't a peace process going on is that there are a handful of bad actors standing in the way of a huge number of people who are longing for a peace process. And would that it was so, but it isn't. We are a really long way off the kind of negotiations that Obama is rightly talking about. You know, the first thing is going to have to be a series of cessations or small truces, or the language
humanitarian,
you know, to try and lower the temperature enough to get some humanitarian aid in. But here's the problem: Israel is not going to accept Hamas as a negotiating partner ever after October the 7th, and Hamas is dug in to tunnels, you know, in very, very sensitive parts of Gaza, and it's going to take a long time to get them out. The leadership of Hamas is dispersed. Many of them live in palatial circumstances in Qatar, in Doha. So the business of dismantling Hamas, which I think is the prelude to everything else, I think there are two regime changes that need to happen. One is in Gaza, and the second is in Israel. I think, you know, until Netanyahu's gone, there can't be a peace process.
But if Hamas is embedded in the fabric of...
Yes.
Gazan society? How do you completely eradicate
it? It's incredibly difficult because you have two bits of international laws of war up against each other. One is the law of proportionality and the idea that you don't hit citizens and so on. But the other is, which is not being mentioned as often in these discussions, but is extremely important, is the law of distinction, which is that if you are Hamas, you have a duty under the Geneva Conventions not to put your HQ under a huge hospital, which is exactly what they've done.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate fact is that the Israelis arguably have a case for what they're doing precisely because all of the heart of Gaza's infrastructure and command centers are so tightly knitted into civilian life, public services and so on. It's horrific. And so the process of rooting out Hamas is going to take a long time. The worst idea anyone has mentioned so far is Netanyahu's proposal that Israel will step in and take over Gaza for an indefinite period.
Yeah.
That is a recipe for, just basically a forever war.
Well, that is an occupation then, isn't it?
Which is, but it's worse because it will. That means that the temperature remains red hot indefinitely.
Yeah.
I think from the very start, we've agreed that somehow there needs to be an interregnum, a multinational presence in Gaza to rebuild. Because it'll take a decade to rebuild the
isn't this what was possibly on the cards there and what Hamas was kicking against? The normalization of relationships with Saudi and Qatar and all of these things. It was all looking like there was a trajectory where a two-state solution become realistic.
Again, we reach an awkward fact. Mm. Hamas doesn't want a two-state solution.
No, of course,
It wants a caliphate.
Which is why it blew it up. That's why it acted like it did.
And so, Blinken says, let's give the Palestinian Authority that runs the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, authority over the Gazans.
Yeah.
Well, okay, but, Abbas is an aging man. His authority is already pretty weakened in the West Bank. The idea that he's going to be able to do what's going to be needed in Gaza as well, I would question that. I do, nation building is not a fashionable word these days, but I actually think that Gaza is going to need some pretty serious, it's going to need a lot of money and it's going to need some very serious international nation building if this is not going to simply end up with Gaza reduced to sort of a stone age of despair.
Well, I was looking through the pictures on our photo agency last night for the New European, and I mean, there are huge swathes of it have already been leveled. There's acres of rubble in the north, obviously, and pictures of tanks bursting through walls and blowing the shit out of stuff. Where I kind of feel that there's an awkwardness, a tension for people. Well, I'll speak for myself, and if anybody else feels this tension, then I won't be surprised, but I won't try and speak for anybody else. My instinct is, it's not for me to say to Israel, enough. 10,000 dead and counting, 4,000 kids dead and counting, 2,000 women.
You'd have to be a psychopath to want that to carry on.
Yeah. So that's one point, and that's touching on proportionality.
Yes.
But my other point around the same issue is a strategic point, which is, isn't it absolutely obvious that this response is exactly what Hamas wants and has planned for? And is, if you talk about wanting to create a caliphate and wanting to instill generation of rage and hatred, this is going to be the end product, isn't it, of what's happening right now?
Possibly. But I think the Israeli response to that would be they did it anyway.
Isn't this the complexity that Obama's talking about?
Yes, it is. But I think that where we sometimes go wrong in the West is that we assume that beneath scratch everyone and they're all London liberals, that the people who are at risk of radicalization, assuming they're not radicalized already, if Israel does something, will in fact turn into nice Remainers, if you like.
Yeah.
And I think that is to misunderstand quite what's happening there. I mean, the fact is that Gaza is now already a jihadi enclave. You know, not everyone in Gaza agrees with Hamas, but enough of them do that to say, watch out because you'll be radicalizing a new generation, certainly for the Israelis, is an insufficient deterrent. Mm. The other thing that is underestimated, I think, is that Israel no longer cares about world opinion. It did, but it doesn't now. They watch, I mean, having spoken to a few people who are in Israel and thankfully so far safe, they've really been affected watching the marches. Yeah. You know, because the point that a lot of them make time and time again is that and it is a good point, is that the marches and the rallies started before the Israeli response.
Yeah.
So now, you know, we're recording this before what could conceivably be quite a tense Saturday in London. There's the armistice day, and then there's the whole growing controversy about the pro-Palestine march. Now, I think, you know, a lot of the people who go on that march is straightforwardly saying the violence must stop.
Yeah.
But the Israelis say, yeah, but the marches began before then.
Yeah.
So what were they protesting? And they say, the Israelis, they're protesting against our existence. And they note too, and I think, again, this is a good point, the UN has passed a lot of resolutions since October the 7th. It has yet to pass a single resolution condemning Hamas's terrorist attacks.
Right.
And that is a disgrace.
It is. If you want to get a picture of how complex it is, I'd commend people to tune into a brilliant podcast by Jonathan Friedland and Yonit Levy. Yonit is a TV news anchor in Israel, so obviously lives in Israel,
yes,
and is feeling this from inside Israel. Jonathan Friedland is looking at this as part of the Jewish diaspora.
Yes.
And the most recent episode, maybe it's been superseded by now, but it's the one, I think they called it War Therapy or something like this, is where they have this most extraordinary conversation about the hurt that I think both of them have felt about how their view of the world, which pre the 7th of October, I think, was they were pretty aligned, cigarette paper between them. And then tensions crept in about whether Jonathan felt that Israel were losing the war, the PR war, if you like, the global PR war. Yonit feeling like you don't know what you're talking about because you're not inside feeling this and we're at a war, and can't people just say this is an atrocity, you have carte blanche. That's simplifying their argument. It's a fascinating debate.
It's really good. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes, please. And by the way, I'm starting to go through their back catalogue. And
it's
if you want
podcast,
to start, terrific. And Johnny also wrote a really good piece, I think, in the Guardian, one of these few journalists that I look on jealously, as indeed I looked on you jealously when you were further afield. But he wrote this brilliant piece about saying, you know, here's the complexity, the problem, the nub of the issue is that you've got two just causes here. You've got two nations on the same plot of land, both with a right to exist, both with a claim to nationhood. And that's the complexity. So people saying, you know, it's Palestine and it should all be Palestine, or people saying from the other point of view about Israel's right to, you know, to go in and settle in the West Bank and all of this stuff, you know, that's unhelpful. What is helpful, possibly, is how do you start thinking about how do these two communities live together in peace
and
security?
Yes, and it is very difficult because the factor in all of this that should never be underestimated is time.
Yeah.
If you watch sort of the programs we do and listen to the podcasts we do and read the newspapers we do, there's a creeping impatience. You can feel it.
Yeah.
With, come on, you know, okay, guys, you've had your month of tearing chunks out of each other. Now it's time to resume business as usual and go to the peace table. Well, business as usual was not going to the peace table. There was a very unhealthily negotiated, but nonetheless, you know, there was a ceasefire, which Hamas broke on October the 7th.
Yeah.
And we're barely a month out from that. And the hostages are still, at the time of recording, in Gaza. Mm. And so, yeah, you know, there are two causes here, but they're not going to be negotiated, I'm afraid, anytime soon.
No, and this is a point that Yonit makes in that podcast about the clock's always ticking for Israel. He said, you know, the clock was never ticking for the United States after 9/11.
Yes.
It was like, you know, on you go, and there was no limit to. He said, but there's a sense within Israel that the rest of the world has got a stopwatch on them and saying, okay, you've had long enough now to kick the shit out of them. It's time now to move on. And that feels, from an Israeli's point of view inside Israel, as different. You know, we're being treated differently. It's exceptionalism. You know, why should Israel not be given the same...
Look, you know, to argue their case, just for sake of argument, the Palestinian people have been through multiple degradations and sufferings, including the horrific way they were treated in the Syrian civil war. I didn't see anyone marching through London then.
Right.
Israel does have a point. It's always Israel that prompts the marches.
And one other fascinating point, I don't want to, this has turned into an advert for Jonathan Friedland's podcast, which wasn't...
Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that.
But they, in a previous one, they had Simon Sebag Montefiore.
Oh, yes,
who made this brilliant point, I think, which counters... He made a number of brilliant points about the artifice of some of the arguments against Israel's right to exist. But one of them was the cheek of people to march to say that you have no right to live as a Jew in Israel because you've colonized this land, when the same people would never dream of saying to somebody who was living in Birmingham, for instance, for 3, 4, 5 generations, you're not British.
Yes.
You know, well, of course they're Israeli. Of course Israel exists de facto. It's
I mean,
fact.
Jews have been living in what has been variously known as Palestine, Israel and other things for thousands of years.
Yeah,
the other thing is that we always hear about the expulsion of the Palestinians from that small plot of land. We rarely hear about the expulsion of Jews from the surrounding Arab states. It wasn't one-way traffic.
Yeah.
You know, this was a rearrangement post-war, post-Holocaust of how that area of the Middle East would be, you know, allotted. And it was ugly.
A lot of it seems to depend on how you choose to calibrate your microscope, doesn't it? It's like, are you just looking at the last 30, 40 years? Are you looking at the last 100 years? Are you looking at the last several hundred
years? Yes, and it's worth remembering that Hamas doesn't think about 1948. It doesn't think about the foundation of the State of Israel. It thinks about 1924, when the caliphate fell.
Mm.
That's what bothers Hamas. So one needs to be, you know, if one is sort of, what's the original sin for Hamas? That's the original sin.
Yeah.
I just think that we're going to be talking about this for a long while to go. And I hope we're recording this on Thursday. There's some talk today that there might be a 3-day cessation to let some humanitarian aid in. Let's hope that that comes to something. I mean, that would be great, wouldn't it?
It would. And one thing that I'd like to just give people an insight into is the challenges as somebody trying to edit a newspaper and make decisions about. This is the hardest thing I think I've come across, because we're a newspaper that says things. You know, we're not just reporting the news. We're trying to say something. We've had really great columns. You know, you've written some fantastic columns. Paul Mason, I thought, wrote a great column about Keir Starmer's view on...
Yeah, but columns are a different thing.
They are. And you know, the New European says stuff on its front page each week. And I found it impossible as yet to know what to do on the front page that says something that, one, isn't crass, which is so easy to get that wrong, but also something that's helpful. You know, like Private Eye did their cover the other day, the one before last, where they got pilloried by a lot of people, and it said something like, warning, this newspaper...
Private Eye for an Eye.
Yeah, Private Eye for an Eye, and this magazine may contain criticism offensive, of the Israeli government and suggests that killing all the Palestinians isn't a long-term solution. That felt to me like... I love Private Eye, but that felt like, to me, unhelpful and a misstep and crass. And I haven't yet thought of how do we tell this story on the front page of the New European. Maybe it'll come to me. Maybe it'll, some great photograph will appear.
Well,
but
I mean,
not as yet.
Inevitably, our thoughts turn in this regard to Suella Braverman,
yes,
don't they?
Good segue,
she never fails to come through when it comes to, I mean, if you're thinking about covers. And as we've mentioned, we're recording this on Thursday and still reeling slightly from her piece in The Times.
Incredible.
I was saying to you before we started that I always think, right, this is, she can get no worse.
Yeah.
But she always proves me wrong.
Do you think she's doing it on purpose?
Well, I mean, she knows what she's doing. I mean, she's intelligent. She knows perfectly well what she's doing. But she's playing to an American MAGA playbook.
Do you want to just in case people haven't heard?
Well, I mean, just touch on some just to touch on that. Well, there is a tension between the government and the police over whether or not the pro-Palestine march should go ahead on Saturday. I personally think it should. I think that freedom of assembly is defined by letting the marches you might have reservations about go ahead,
yeah,
not the ones that you find easy.
Sure. And if people are chanting incitement to hatred, then lock them up. Fine.
Yeah, and I mean, police it. That's what policing is all about. However, you know, the government has made it abundantly clear that it wants the march banned because it coincides with Armistice Day. But in order for that to happen, the police have to formally request a ban through the Public Order Act. And it's clear that Sir Mark Rowley's not going to do that. So certainly at the time of recording, the march is going ahead. Now, Suella Braverman, as most people know, has helpfully and, you know, in the interests of good relations, described these demonstrations as hate marches. Mm-hmm. In the Times, she raises the game and she expresses implied concern that the police are not policing protests, quote, even-handedly.
Yeah.
What does she mean by that? She spells it out.
Yeah.
She says, during COVID, I'm quoting here, during COVID, why was it that lockdown objectors were given no quarter by public order police, yet Black Lives Matter demonstrators were enabled, allowed to break rules, and even greeted with officers taking the knee?
I mean, she is it's so cynical.
And she's packing everything in. I mean, yeah. And then the bit that I thought was the dog whistle to end all dog whistles was she says at the end, I don't think it's been picked up, actually. Football fans are even more vocal about the tough way they are policed as compared to politically connected minority groups who are favoured by the left. And first of all, I thought, what's that all about? And then I realised, oh, God, because a whole bunch of football firms, so-called football supporting firms, Football Lads Against Extremism, Democratic Football Lads Alliance, I mean, gruesome names, are supposedly coming to London on Saturday to defend the cenotaph and so on. I mean, one hopes they don't come, and one hopes that if they do come, they just stand there and do nothing.
I've seen a procession of people on Instagram, usually big fat bald blokes in Union Jack shorts saying, in Marbella, saying, right, lads, you know what needs to be done, naff said. You know,
yeah, I mean,
stereotypical.
Let's have a straightener, you know. Right. And I have to say, it's not, thank you, Elon, a great coincidence that Tommy Robinson has returned to Twitter, you know, and he's saying, you know, come and defend the nation and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Suella Braverman really has, and we've learned today, Thursday, that Number 10 did not clear the article. I maintain I don't think Sunak will sack her. I think, or at least he certainly doesn't want to, although she is making it really hard.
Why wouldn't he sack her? Because he finds her useful.
Because he's beholden to her, because she's popular in the party, and because if she is of course she's planning a leadership bid, that's easier from the back benches.
Have her in the tent pissing out.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that the bigger point is that there are few things more despicable in politics than using a real war to advance a culture war.
Right.
I mean, how low is that?
Yeah. So one thing that puzzled me were, unless there is a smart explanation, as you've just provided with the football fans, the allusion to Northern Ireland struck me as balmy. She said, you can see the resonance in these pro-Palestinian marches in what we used to see in Northern Ireland, in marches where you've got one section of society trying to gain dominance. And the people who march in Northern Ireland most are Protestants,
yes,
the Orangemen,
who are
all complete, you know.
That was just plain stupid.
Right, because, so she has fouled
because,
up.
Because, not only is what you say true, but also the Parades Commission in Northern Ireland, which has been around since 1998, so quarter of a century, has been one of the great successes of the Ulster peace process, because what it does, and you can go to their website, is they list all the marches on both sides of the community and they ensure the routes and the timings are all, you know, so there won't be any trouble. And they've really done a great job.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, the Northern Ireland symmetry is complete nonsense.
It just seems
it's
dangerous. It's obviously dangerous territory for a UK politician to start spouting off about things they don't like about Northern Ireland culture and society. And yet she made the point repeatedly, and it was such a pointed
Yes.
Point.
I think there was something there. This goes back to a point that we made in the last Q&A, which is actually the Conservative Party is now the English Party.
Right. You know, well, listen, we're going to have to take a quick break.
Let's take a quick break.
But if you know why Suella, if you've got a clever answer for why Suella
Braverman, let us know.
Brought Northern Ireland into the fight, then do drop us a line at twomats@tnepublishing.com. And we'll see you after the break. This week's episode is sponsored by The New European. And boy, oh boy, do we have a seasonal gift for you if you subscribe.
What's that, Santa?
It is. And I shouldn't be laughing, but it's an absolutely
deadly serious.
It's a fantastically funny set of 6 Christmas cards and a 2024 wall calendar.
Also seriously funny, yeah, I'll be bound.
But they are bloody funny.
Bloody funny.
And I even wrote some of the gags myself. Then
it's a lock.
It is an absolute lock-in. And you can get those 6 cards and your fantastic wall calendar to give you laughs all the way through 2024. And to make all of your friends think you are the funniest person on the block when they get your Christmas card, if you subscribe to The New European. And The New European, if you don't know, is a fantastic newspaper and website full of great serious political analysis from great writers like the very fantastic Matthew D'Ancona. Do you know him?
Seen here.
Relative?
Very cousin, I think.
Patience Wheatcroft. Bonnie Greer,
James Ball,
Tannicock, Jonty Bloom, Will Self, stellar stuff.
And
Alistair Campbell's Diary is an absolute.
It's a must.
It's an absolute must read. And it's also got loads of fantastic cultural commentary and features, stuff, left field stuff you won't read anywhere else. But if you love Europe and you want to get a sense of why Europe is a fantastic continent and a great place we all love, then The New European was literally made for you. So subscribe and join our fight against right-wing nationalistic media and do something positive about the state of the press in the UK.
Yes, sir.
You can get everything we do online for just £1 a week. Or if you like the actual newspaper delivered to your door every single week, then you can have that for another £1. And that's a 75% saving on what you'd pay at the newsagent. Just go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats, number 2, MATTS. Do it now and you'll get your Christmas cards and calendar in plenty of time for the festive season, and you'll be supporting great independent journalism. Thank you.
This month on The Modern Man, the award-winning magazine show for your ears, we tell the story of Kaz Jane, a woman who takes police officers into the woods and makes them cry. Plus, we explore the trend for philanthrotainment. Is it right for YouTubers to become charities? And our resident relationships expert, Alex Fox, tackles dating after bereavement. And there's music and your letters. It's a packed show. Join me, Ollie Mann, on The Modern Man. That's MANN, yes, it's a pun on my name. Find us wherever you get your podcasts, or there's a link in the show notes.
Over on the Media Podcast this week, Reach announces layoffs of almost 10% of their staff. We look at why. Also on the programme, BBC Studios enters the audio market, as does James Corden, and why Carol Vorderman becomes the first casualty of Lineker's Law. Plus, in the Media Quiz, we pit the pundits against each other in our very own Squid Games. That's the Media Podcast with me, Matt Deegan, available wherever you get your podcasts, or clicking on the link in the show notes.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back, listeners. Hope you're taking something out of the show and enjoying it. Now, talking about from the sublime to the ridiculous. No, the nasty, racist, horrible, bigoted Home Secretary to the ridiculous.
Just to the ridiculous.
Nadine Dorries.
Well, it's a great week for literature because Nadine Dorries' latest book, always a great week for literature, right? When and she continues her exploits as a fiction writer, not quite fiction writer, but in the publication of this book, The Plot.
Yeah.
Now I have only read what's been serialized in the Daily Mail.
You haven't bought it.
Well, I haven't bought it. I don't think it's actually in the shops yet. I'm agog by the letterbox waiting for my the publishers have promised me a review copy, so I can't wait for that. But I mean, to people who don't know, Nadine Dorries, you know, Capsule, there's so much. I mean, she was culture secretary under Boris Johnson, hated the BBC, didn't know how Channel 4 was funded, ordered a bunch of cultural institutions out of London in the name of levelling up. She stood down as MP for Mid-Bedfordshire after the fall of Johnson, but said she wouldn't leave until she was told why she'd been refused a peerage in Johnson's resignation on this. She's got so much form. Yeah. She lost the whip in 2012-13 for going on I'm a Celebrity, etc., etc. Anyway, she's now written this book, The Plot, which is all about how wicked, evil conspirators brought down the great Boris Johnson.
I thought this should Dorries Through the Looking Glass would have been a, would have been a better title. But some of it's mad. But there's enough interest in it to take it sort of semi-seriously, isn't
well,
it?
Well, we've discussed before that Dominic Cummings, who's one of the villains of this book, which I gather is quite long, dauntingly long, did indeed, you know, say to Laura Kunzberg after the... I think in 2021 that he and his pals, the Vote Leave gang, people like Lee Kane and others, had indeed plotted to bring down Boris Johnson days after the 2019 election. And it's true that there is a group of like-minded people who, as she says, tend to sort of identify with Michael Gove. One of them is a character called Dougie Smith.
Yeah, he's fascinating.
Well, I've done a little bit of digging into him in the past. I actually knew him a bit in the 90s. And he's a sort of fascinating... He's one of these figures that genuinely... almost never gets seen in the spotlight. I think the Daily
Mail... There's one photograph of him.
There's two now. There's one from the 90s, and I think the Daily Mail caught one of him more recently. But he's very, very rarely seen around.
None of them at the swingers' parties he used to run.
He used to run swingers' parties. Yeah. He is married very happily to Boris Johnson's former policy chief, Munira Mirza, a former revolutionary communist. The plot thickens.
Yeah.
And he's the fixer. I mean, he fixes everything. He fixes safe seats. He fixes scandals. He's the muscle.
How does a guy? I mean, there's the Conservative Party has an organization with, one would hope, functioning departments and mechanisms for all of this stuff. How do you get an organization where you get these shadowy characters? There's him. There's also this Dr. No.
Well, one has to be tread slightly carefully legally, but I would suggest that Dr. No is one of the named individuals, but that she has decided to take Dr. No out because she's alarmed at what might happen if she attributes the, there are various sort of
interestingly
things.
She said that that she'd named him, but the I think the Daily Mail lawyers, the Mail have been serializing the book, the Mail lawyers have said we can't go with the Dr. No stuff and naming him with our X, Y, and Z in place, and that would have delayed publication by 6 months. She wanted,
and she'd already did. It was meant to come out before the Tory conference. Right, so right. I mean, and the Cabinet Office had been having kittens over the whole thing. So suffice it to say, I'm fairly sure that Dr. No is one of the people that is named in the book, rather than an additional character.
Yeah.
But one of the truly bonkers things about the book is that it keeps referring to people by code names. So not only Dr. No, but she's got a source called Thumper, Bambi, Moneypenny. I initially saw Dominic Cummings as Oddjob to Gove's Goldfinger. I mean, this is fairly deranged stuff. Yeah. And the funny thing is, I think Dominic Cummings has had a great time responding to this, both to journalists and on X, on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because, of course, what it's doing is giving it's giving him fantastic cover.
Yeah.
Because everyone understandably thinks this is the work of a crazy person.
Yeah.
Actually, at the heart of it, there is a kernel of truth, which is that there has been, especially in the last few years, since Brexit, a group, I don't know whether it's called itself the movement, but that it operates in a very militaristic way with Cummings and Gove at the heart of it all. And she's right about that. And they did play a big part in the downfall of Johnson. They did. Yeah. Although the person who played the biggest part in the downfall of Johnson was Johnson.
It was Boris Johnson.
Let's not get too kind of conspiracy theory
to channel
about this.
Douglas Murray, there was someone who ruined
and
your
life. And it was you. So, you know, even if these people hadn't existed, I think he wouldn't be prime minister now. But anyway, I think it's given, it's paradoxically given a new lease of life to the movement.
One fascinating element of this, I thought, was, and it is a real insight into the kind of shenanigans that must go on, but and would drive you nuts if you were the Secretary of State, as she was. Apparently, she recommended Michael Grade for the chairman of Ofcom.
Ofcom.
Yeah. Put the note into her ministerial red box. Red box was delivered to Johnson. By the time Johnson opened it, there was someone else's name on the recommendation. She was then told about this by some back channel, phoned up Johnson and said, this is a disgrace.
Yeah.
I recommended Grade, and Grade eventually got the job. But somebody somewhere, according to Nadine Dorris, had interfered with her letter to the Prime Minister. I mean, it sounds utterly mad because it wasn't going to escape her notice that at some point Michael Grade hadn't got the gig. But if that is going on, that...
Well, the thing is that if there are conspiracies and deep states and so on going running Britain, this is a great week for them, right? Because no one will now believe in it, right? Yeah. I mean, it really is that old thing, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was persuading the world he didn't exist.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what Nadine Dorries has just done for all the sinister forces in British public life.
Right.
Nice one.
Brilliant. Right. Well, that's. I'm sure we'll hear more from Nadine at some point in the near future. What didn't we have time to talk about?
Well,
this week?
Obviously we didn't really talk about the King's speech, which I think it shows wisdom on our part, because it wasn't. I just think one has to pay tribute to the phrase "the scourge of unlicensed pedicabs." I mean, that is up there with, you know, ask not what your country can do for
it's
you.
It's the scourge of unlicensed pedicures. That's
pedicures, and, you know, it was unbelievable.
The best bit of it all, which I think is worth noting, was Starmer. I thought Starmer was brilliant.
Starmer in the debate.
On Suella Braverman.
Yes.
He was brilliantly scripted. He delivered it brilliantly, and it was chilling. He said, basically, you can't be a serious prime minister unless you've got a serious Home Secretary, and she is not a serious Home Secretary. And they were jam-packed on the front row, as they always are. But somehow, the body language between Sunak, who was sitting next to Braverman, but his head was about 5 feet away from hers by the time Starmer had finished. He was like, you could tell there was this gulf between them and a great deal of embarrassment. Not enough to sack her. Well, unless we find out otherwise,
I mean,
in the future.
Her future will also be resolved to some extent by how the Supreme Court rules on Rwanda, which is a very important moment for this government.
Yeah.
The other thing we didn't talk about which again you drew to my attention, and you know, imagine my shock, is that Caramac has been discontinued after 64 years by Nestle.
Come on, Nestle. Of all the weeks to drop that bad news, the world has had enough. Not
you know, it's
now.
Pretty bad time. Yeah. I love their... They said we'd made the difficult decision to discontinue it. Difficult decision is one of my favourite euphemisms because it's been... I think it was the Cameron Osborne years where it became... It got into the bloodstream generally. It meant we're going to close your hospital or we're going to take away your benefits or, you know, we're going to turn your life support system off. Yeah, you know, we've made a difficult decision. Yeah. But I do like the idea that, you know, abolishing a much loved form of confectionery,
I think it was probably my
difficult decision.
My favourite chocolate bar or Caramac bar, caramel bar.
We shall not see its like again.
It's a shame. Well, there's another one, isn't there? Caramilk, I think, by
there's
Cadbury's.
There's all sorts of nonsense.
And they got rid of red bounty bars. Did you see that? The dark chocolate bounties.
I mean, you know.
You said, all our childhood has been ripped away from us.
It's just, you know, before our very eyes, really. There's no respect anymore.
On that saddest of sad notes, we're going to bid you adieu. Thank you for listening. Don't forget your special subscriptions offer where you can get your hilarious Christmas cards and 2024 calendar for free by signing up to the New European, which is Britain's fastest growing newspaper. We want to say a big thank you to our production team led by the third Matt Hill. Thank you, guys. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.